listeners.
Hey.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it's an episode. And you know what we do for these things. We talk about board games. Most of the time. Sometimes we don't. This time we are talking about a board game. So Matthew, what board game are we talking about today?
We are talking about The Palace of Mad King Ludwig, designed by Ted Alsbach and published in 2017 by Bezier Games.
All right. Now, we have talked about a game with a similar title before. That was Between Two Castles of Mad King Ludwig. But yes, this game predates that game, correct?
Yeah, this is the sequel to The Castle of Mad King Ludwig. And Between Two Castles was the threequel slash spinoff.
I see. All right, so Palace of Mad King Ludwig. For a short description of what this game is, by the way, I'll go and do a short description as always. Then we're going to talk about how to play the game and the strategy. You know, this is our usual episode structure. And then we'll have a short break in the middle. And then afterwards, we'll talk about design. So to give a short description of what Palace of Mad King Ludwig is about. In Palace of Mad King Ludwig, players place rooms inside a castle in order to score points, collect bonuses, and compete for the favor of the Mad King. As rooms are completed, by connecting all of their doors to other rooms, players add moats to the outer border of the rooms in the castle. Once the moat closes the perimeter of the castle off, the game ends. Bonus points are awarded from favors, and the player with the most points wins. So, it's a tile placement game. You could maybe compare it to something like Carcassonne, but you are creating a castle by placing rooms, and you place the rooms by connecting their doors to other rooms in the castle. And every room, once you place it, or once you complete it, rather, provides an effect for you, or potentially for other players, if you complete their rooms. And throughout the game, you just earn points from completing these rooms and performing other objectives, including completing favors, which are like secret objectives. So let's get into gameplay and strategy.
Yes. Let's see.
So I think we should start off with how the game is set up.
Sure.
Because that leads right into a couple strategy points. So the way the game is set up, each player is dealt a player tableau, which has
a blueprint board.
It's called a blueprint board in this game. The notable features are there are 7 trackers that you use to track how many of each type of room you have placed in the castle. There are 7 kinds of rooms. Some of them are hallways and stairs, which function a little differently than the other rooms in this game, namely in that they don't appear in the main stack of tiles that you draw from. They're in their own separate stacks, and they can be built at any point and added to the castle at any point for your turn. So you get these player tableaus to track that. The other notable feature is there are 6 slots on the edges of the board, 3 on the left side, 3 on the right, which serve dual functions. The first of which is one of the actions that you take in a game could result in you placing a room tile slotted diagonally into the slot. And this gives you a sort of upgrade that will either affect you for the rest of the game or give you some sort of bonus at the end of the game. For example, it could give you 10 bonus points, or it could give you 3 bonus swans, which is like the currency in this game. We'll get into those later. The other way that these slots are used is as favors. So there are another tile in the game that have a yellow heart on the back to show that they're a favor. And on the front side, they have some sort of objective, which usually involves having the most or least of a certain kind of resource or room attributed to yourself.
In fact, it always includes involving having the most or least of something.
So it could be like having the most blue swan currency. It could be having the most brown rooms in the castle. It could be having the fewest orange rooms in the castle. So these are favors, and you slot the pieces in sort of at right angles. You know, I just said diagonally is how you slot in the rooms to get the upgrades, but not diagonal is how you slot in the favors to get those. You only have these 6 slots, and if you put something in a slot, that means you can't put something else there later. So if you put a favor in a slot, that means you can no longer get that upgrade for the rest of the game.
Yeah.
So that's the player tableau. Each player also has a certain like piece of a different shape, depending on what color tableau you're given. You get these different colored pieces I think for the blue player with the blue blueprint board, which is a little redundant, but it's just how the game works. Your pieces are like little music notes. For the player with the brown blueprint board, your pieces are little keys. So everyone gets a big pile of these little pieces, and these pieces serve a couple different functions. You use these pieces on your tracker to track how many rooms you have of each kind, those seven tracker rows. And then whenever you place a room in the castle, you place one of these pieces on top of that room to show that you are the person who placed that room there. And then these pieces have two sides. They have a white side and they have a filled in side. So either a white side or a brown side for the brown pieces, white or blue for the blue pieces. And you flip the piece over whenever a room is completed. So, and a room is completed when its doors connect to other doors for other rooms in the castle. All of its doors connect to another door.
Right.
That connects it with the castle. So that's how you set up. And I want to mention that, those are the pieces that a player gets. And at the start of the game, each player is dealt three favor tokens or three favor tiles, and they get to choose one or none, if they so choose, to keep and place in one of their slots. And four favor tiles are dealt face up onto the main playing area for public favors. And the way that public favors versus private favors, which are the ones that slot into your tableau worker, any player can get the points from the public favors, but only the person who's acquired a private favor can get the points from that. So first strategy point is see what the public favors are, and then look at the private favors you've been dealt at the start of the game, and try and pick a set of favors that work together. So like if one of the public favors is have the most green swans, and one of your private favors is just have the most swans in general, those two can work together pretty well. Finding ways that they match up is a good strategy.
Right. And certain rooms will synergize with certain other rooms or strategies, which we can get to a bit later.
Mm-hmm. Like if your thing is to have the most favors, you can get more favors by completing, I don't know what room.
Food rooms.
Food rooms? I thought that was, which one is bonuses? Sleeping rooms? Okay. So yeah, food rooms give you more favors. So if you want to have more favors, then you would also want to have favors that say have the most food rooms, because those two would work together.
Right. Or living rooms give you a lot of swans, and so those work well with favors that require specific colors of swans.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about these room types. When you set up the game, you take all of the room tiles that are not hallways or stairs, and you kind of mix them all together in a giant pile, and then you make five stacks of roughly the same height. That's literally what it says, is it says five stacks of roughly the same height.
Right.
Roughly equal height. And then you place these in five sort of spots on the like castle board. This board is like, it's grass on opposite sides of a bridge, and then the bridge is what connects into the castle. And then the castle itself is placed on the front side of this board, which has some water on it. So there are, at any point, I believe, six room tiles that are face up in like a trade row. And then whenever people buy new tiles or place new tiles from there, you draw the top tiles of the leftmost stack of tiles, add them to that trade row, and eventually you'll run out of one stack, and that means that the space beneath it is revealed, which we'll explain in a moment.
All right, so let's talk about player actions and what you do on your turn.
Yes.
So on your turn, you can take one of four actions, I believe.
I think so.
The first is placing a room, in which you choose a room from the trade row like that you described. There are six face-up tiles here. You choose one of those rooms to add to the castle, and then you must add it to the castle in a way that at least keeps one upstairs door available for rooms to be attached to.
Yes, you always have to have the castle possible to expand out from.
Yes, and upstairs, it might sound confusing, but that will be explained when I explain the second action you can take. By the way, the trade row, there are two slots that are free of cost. There are two slots where you have to pay a swan to get the room in those slots. And there's two slots that you have to pay 2 swans to acquire the rooms from those slots. And as you acquire rooms, they slide towards the free side of that trade row. So a room that might have cost 2 swans after a couple of turns may become free of charge. By the way, there's some upgrades that allow you to ignore some or all of the costs for these rooms in the trade row.
Yeah.
So there's rooms in the trade row. The second action that you can take is to place stairs or a hallway into the castle. So there's 2 kinds of rooms that we keep mentioning that don't go into the stacks of rooms with the other rooms in this game. Those are hallways and stairs. So hallways have 4 entrances always. There's 5 different colors of swans. We haven't mentioned that, but the 5 colors of swans are green, yellow, red, blue, and purple. And any given hallway will have 4 rooms of different colors. And then whatever the 5th color is that it doesn't have, or sorry, 4 doors of different colors. And whatever color the 5th door is, or the 5th, whatever 5th color is missing, whenever that hallway is completed, you get 2 of that swan.
And then the other one is stairways, which right. have a light and dark side signifying the upstairs and downstairs side. When you build it, you place it connected to any room in the house. As long as the upstairs side is touching an upstairs room, or the downstairs side is touching a downstairs room. Additionally, you can place upstairs ends of a stairway next to another upstairs end of a stairway, but you cannot do so for downstairs ends of stairways. And some of the rooms in the like stack of rooms are basement tiles, which can only be placed connected to either downstairs stairway sides or other basement tiles.
Right. So when people place stairs and this creates a downstairs, like I mentioned, you have to keep at least 1 upstairs door open at all times when you're placing rooms in the castle, but you can close off downstairs rooms if you want to. Okay. And yeah, like you mentioned, there's downstairs rooms mixed into the room tiles. Okay, so there's place a room from the trade row. There's place a room or place stairs or hallways.
Oh,
by the way,
yeah.
When you place a stair or hallway, you don't have to pay any swans. And when you take that action to place a stair or hallway, you can also, as part of that action, remove a room from the trade row. But if you do that, you have to pay any swans that you would have paid to acquire that room.
Right. You could just remove one of the free tiles for free. Or you could pay extra swans to take something further ahead that maybe might be more important for somebody.
Yeah. You can pay extra swans to remove it, something that you know somebody wants to place. Like if somebody's been collecting a lot of green swans and there's a living room that has a bunch of green doors on it, you might want to get rid of that so that they don't get to cash in on that.
Right. The next action is to gain a bonus.
Yep.
In which you pay 3 swans. And you take 1 of the room tiles in the trade row, paying any additional swans as indicated, and you place it as 1 of your bonus slots, which again means to place it diagonally in 1 of the edges of the board, of your blueprint board, I mean.
Right.
And that unlocks that bonus for the rest of the game. I guess we should go ahead and mention what these are.
Real quick, I just want to touch on the 4th and final action, which is gain a favor, in which case you pay 3 swans. And then you draw the top 3 favor tiles from the favor tile stack. You choose 1 or none to keep, and you slot them into your board, as indicated.
The rest go on the bottom.
Yeah. Same thing happens, by the way, to all the favors you're dealt at the beginning of the game. Any favors that don't get used get put on the bottom of the favor tile stack.
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, let's talk about the bonuses that you can unlock.
Right. So the left side has bonuses that are active throughout the game. There are 2 bonuses that reduce the cost of swan actions by 1, or they reduce the swan cost by 1. So what that means is if you get 1 of them, then buying from the 3rd and 4th space on the trade row will be free. Buying from the 5th and 6th space on the trade row will cost 1 swan, and then buying a favor or a bonus tile will cost 2. And then likewise, there's an additional slot that lets you get another swan off the price.
Mm-hmm.
Then the final one on the left side is, oh, we should probably mention moat tiles.
Well, we'll get to that after we finish describing these.
Well, the final one on the left side lets you move two moat tiles.
Mm-hmm.
So keep that in mind. Then on the right side of the bonus blueprint board, there are three slots that interact with the way you gain points at the end of the game. The first one gives you a flat 10 points. The second one lets you win ties in favor tiles. Normally, if there is a tie for a favor tile, so like if it's fewest, or if it's like most entertainment rooms built, and you and another player have tied for the most at 4, if you don't have this bonus, then nobody will get points. But if you do, then you will get points if you tie for any of your favor tiles.
Mm-hmm.
Very useful.
And you get the maximum number of points. Even if there's a tie between two players, if both of them have this bonus unlocked, both players get the maximum number of points.
Yes, this is almost mandatory.
That is when dealing with a public favor. If there's a private favor, then like say you have the private favor of having the fewest. Now that I think about it, there aren't brown swans, are there?
No,
there's just brown rooms. So let's just say you have fewest purple swans as a private favor. So only you can earn points from that. If you don't have the tie and both you and another player have 0 purple swans, you get 0 points. If they have the tie, they don't get the points because it's not their private favor. It's your private favor. But if you do have the tie and it's your private favor and you do tie with somebody, you still get the max number of points for a private favor.
Right. Highly recommend it.
Yes.
And then
the final bonus.
Yeah, the final bonus gives you 3 swans of the colors of your choice at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is because...
And that can help.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
This is because swans give you points at the end of the game per, like, set of differently colored swans.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but also because they could help you get the most swans of a certain kind if you have that private favor.
Yeah, you do it before checking favors.
Yes.
So,
all right. Moats.
I was just going to say that one swan of one color is 1 point. 2 swans is 2 points.
Yep.
3, I believe, is 4.
Yep.
4 is
7.
7. And then 5 is 10.
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
All right. So there's 2 big questions that we haven't answered yet. And that's, how do you get swans during the game? And what are moat tiles? Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about both of those because they both stem from similar circumstances in the game. So when you place a room connected to another room, you have to line up their doors. And every door in the game will be a certain color, except for gray doors, which are sort of wild. They're gray is wild. Just keep that in mind. So when you line up the doors on 2 rooms and the color matches, then whoever owns those rooms gets a swan. So if it's you connecting a red door to another player's room, and they also have a red door, so you're connecting their red doors together, both you and that player get a red swan. Now, you can only get 1 swan per door match, so if you own both rooms, you only get 1 swan. However, if placing a room connects 2 sets of doors, then you could potentially get 2 swans, even if you own all of the rooms in that scenario.
Right. And gray is wild, so if you match a red with a gray, then both players get a red swan. If you match a gray with a gray, then both players get the swan of any color that they please.
And they don't have to choose the same color.
Mm-hmm.
Gray doors don't show up often for upstairs tiles, but all basement tiles have gray doors.
Yes.
Okay. So you match up doors to get swans. And then once a room has had all of their doors matched to other rooms, then that room is considered completed. So when that happens, you get the swans, first of all, if that final match to close off the room happened to be the same color. Then you flip your piece over to show that the room has been completed. And then a couple different things happen. Depending on the room, you might get some sort of bonus right away, because every room gives you a bonus when it's completed. Except for utility rooms, I think.
Utility rooms auto complete.
Sure, fair enough. Some rooms give you those bonus like upgrades. Some rooms give you private favors. Some rooms will give you more swans. Some rooms might just give you bonus points at the end of the game. So it depends on the color of the room or the type of room on what kind of bonus you get when it's completed. But then the second thing that happens, and this is important for talking about how the game ends, is depending on how many stacks of room tiles have been depleted on the, you know, the main playing board area, you have to place a number of moat tiles around the perimeter of the castle after every room is completed, or after a room is completed. So if we've eliminated two, let's just start with one. If we've eliminated the first stack of room tiles, there's a symbol that shows one moat tile, and that just means from then on, every time a room is completed, add one moat tile to the board. And you have to start at the front of the castle, closest to the bridge, which is the center of the playing board, and also the place where you start placing tiles. You actually start with three hallway tiles to, like, establish the beginnings of the castle,
yeah,
and then you build off of those. So anyways, you have to start as close to that bridge as possible, filling in the perimeter of the board with moat tiles, placing moat tiles adjacent to other moat tiles, adjacent to other moat tiles and wrapping around the sides of the board. So at the beginning of the game, since the bridge is in the middle of the play area and the palace will expand outwards from there, that means that there's always going to be two sides of the castle for the moat to start at, and then it'll continue to wrap around either side, you know, depending on which side the players choose to add moat tiles to whenever it's their turn to choose. And then eventually they usually meet up somewhere in the middle around the back of the castle.
Yes. So
after you've depleted two stacks, you place two moat tiles every time a room is completed. After the third stack, you place four moat tiles after every room is completed. And then I think it's another two after that for the fourth stack and the fifth stack.
I mean, if it's the fifth stack, the game is over, because that's all the tiles.
Right. There's no more rooms, so you can't complete much.
Yeah.
But it's pretty hard to get to that point, just because, like, once you start completing rooms and adding moat tiles, like, four moat tiles can really wrap around the board quickly.
Yeah, it's sort of like the progression of, like, a co-op board game like Forbidden Island, where it starts to, like, ramp up really quickly.
Yes.
I wanted to mention the placement rules for moat tiles.
Okay.
So you mentioned they have to start as close to the center as possible, and they have to start by touching that moat side of the castle board at the start. From there, they have to be placed orthogonally connected to other moat tiles, with one exception. They have to go around the castle on either side, and when they go around a corner, they have to still be placed orthogonally connected. If there is a pocket of, like a little inlet of however many empty spaces, then those have to be filled in before the moat can keep going around. So there's a good visual of this in the rulebook, but essentially, if you have, like, a space of one room wide that goes about three tiles deep into the castle, so you have, like, two branches of the castle on either side, the water of the moat has to fill up those three empty spaces.
Mm-hmm.
You can fill in any, like, courtyards where it's completely walled off, meaning, like, if there's a hole in the middle of the castle that cannot have a room because there's no doors entering it, you could place a moat there, or you could opt not to. And then finally, you always have to place moats so that there's an available upstairs door to build from, unless you are placing the final moat tile of the game, which would then completely encircle the castle and finish the game.
Right. So the game ends when the castle is entirely encircled by moat. And at that point, everyone counts their bonus points from, you know, how many rooms they placed and what upgrades they received. You count your bonus points from the number of sets of swans that you've acquired, and you count all the bonus points from the favors.
Yes.
Whoever has the most points wins.
Yeah. And then one last thing, I want to go over the individual room types.
Okay.
And just what their completion is. Oh, and we need to mention one last thing about the blueprint board.
Yeah.
So on the blueprint board, there are different trackers for the rooms, as you mentioned, but these also give you bonus points. If you build five of any room type, then you'll get 10 points. And this is for every room type that you build five of.
Mm-hmm.
And then additionally, If you build three of a room type, you get a bonus swan indicated on your blueprint board. So for a living room, it's purple. For utility, it's yellow, I think. No, food room is yellow. Utility is red. Entertainment is green.
Mm-hmm.
And sleeping is blue. And then all the others are gray, which is any color. And then finally, if you get one of every room built, you get 10 points. Two of every room built is 20 points. Three of every room built is 30 points. So these are sort of the columns as opposed to the rows.
Right.
And then the individual room types. So living rooms, when they are completed, they give you another swan of every door that matches the correct color on that living room.
So they sort of like double your correct door matches, but yes, only for you.
Mm-hmm. The food rooms give you a favor tile, so you look at the top three favor tiles, keep one or zero, and then put the rest on the bottom. The sleeping rooms give you a bonus, so just like if you were to buy a bonus, you take a tile from the trade row, paying any costs, put it onto your board in one of the bonus slots, and then continue on afterwards. The utility rooms give you bonus points for other factors at the end of the game.
It's always 3 points per X.
Yeah, so 3 points per red swan, 3 points per activity room built, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And utility rooms always have one door, so they automatically complete.
Yeah, it should be mentioned that for utility rooms, and also for favors and stairs, when we talk about how stairs work, the rooms do not have to be completed for them to score you points. So for utility rooms, like if it's 3 points for every food room that you have in the castle, you don't have to have completed those food rooms for these purposes.
Yeah. So stairways give you, I believe, 3 points per connected basement.
Yes.
Meaning in like a line from that stairway to another stairway or the end of the basements.
Mm-hmm.
The basements give you a mystery swan, a secret swan, which is a black swan that has like a gray color on one side. And if you look at the other side, it has an actual color, one of the five colors. And these just give you bonus points. They essentially just act as a swan of that color that you reveal at the end of the game.
Yeah, if you get to know what they are, but your opponents don't get to know.
Right. If you were to pay one of these mystery swans, then you have to remix it up with the rest of them so nobody knows what it was or where the one you had was. And there are favor tiles for having mystery swans. Then the hallways give you two swans of the indicated color on the tile. And then activity rooms give you 7 points at the end of the game if you've completed them.
So I want to talk about one more rule of this game, but I'll phrase it in the context of strategy so that we can really get into strategy now. And that is that there are situations in which a room can be impossible to complete. So, for example, when you place a room in the castle, at least one of its doors have to connect to another room that eventually connects to the rest of the castle, right? But that doesn't mean all of the doors have to. And that also means that you don't have to connect every room that you could possibly connect if you didn't want to. So if you place a room so that, you know, at least one of the doors is connected, but one of the sides of the room tile that you place might not have a door on it, but it is next to a tile that does have a door on it. This blocks the door of the other room. Meaning that there's never going to be a situation for the rest of the game because it's impossible to move any of these room tiles once they're placed. But there's never going to be a situation where that door in that room gets connected to another door because it's just running into a wall. In that case, it is impossible for that room to be completed because a completed room has to have all of its doors connected to doors in other rooms.
Yeah.
So doing this is important because A, if that room belonged to another player, now it's impossible for that player to get the bonus from that room. So if that was like an entertainment room, now they're no longer going to be getting those 7 points at the end of the game, which is pretty big. Also, it doesn't complete the room, meaning you don't add motes if you're at the stage of the game where you would add motes once rooms are completed. And that could be useful if you're planning on scoring a lot of points later on, but you don't want the game to end so soon.
Right. The other thing is that moats can block off room doors.
Yes, and they will.
Completed. Yes, and so if you have a lot of rooms that are close to the moats that would get filled in if a few rooms were completed, then you'd want to avoid completing rooms so that you can safely build off of your existing rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of like the main form of interaction you have to hinder opponents, is this like carefully blocking off rooms from getting completed.
Mm-hmm. While also placing your rooms so that they do get completed.
Yes.
So depending on the number of players that you're playing with, you know, there could be, you know, there's one to three other players in the game, and they each get a turn before it comes back to you. So, you know, that's one to three turns that players have to potentially block off a room that you just placed. So I want to make two strategy points. So the first point is that you want to block off your opponents, especially, you know, if they are in the lead or perceivably in the lead, because it's a little difficult to determine exactly who's winning at any point in the game. But, you know, if they've completed a lot of other rooms, it's safe to say that they might be pretty in the lead. So you might want to prevent other rooms of theirs from being blocked off or from being completed by blocking them off. So that's one strategy point. The other strategy point is you want to place rooms so that your opponents are incentivized to complete them. For example, if the player who goes after you has a room that's nearly completed, it just has one door left, you can put your room near it with a door facing, you know, the same slot that would be completed, so that when your opponent goes to complete that room, they may inadvertently also complete yours.
Right. There is still risk. You could still get blocked off.
Yeah.
So be aware of what's in the trade row at that moment. You know, mm-hmm. if there's a utility room, it might not be the best play.
There could also be a situation that your opponents won't have enough turns to block off your room. Like, for example, if there's a lot of rooms oriented in such a way that they have walls facing like a central point in the castle, as in they don't have doors facing that way, there's no way, no place to attach rooms to them facing a certain direction, then you can place a door that faces that direction, because it's not like another tile will appear on the other side of that, if that makes sense. Like,
right.
Place a room so that its door is facing a hole in the castle that only has walls surrounding it.
Right. Playing near the center of the castle is pretty important, because that's the furthest from the moats.
Mm-hmm.
And if you expand outward from, like, the center area, then that's even further away from the moats.
Yeah, even rather taking that one step further, expanding outward, or expanding perpendicularly from the castle board.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the moat runs, you know, lengthwise across the table. You want to expand perpendicularly from there to get distance from those moats.
Yeah.
And the further you are from the moat, the more likely the more turns you'll have to complete a room later on. Another strategy for getting your rooms completed or not blocked is to place your rooms in different parts of the castle and not all close to each other, because if there's a situation where two of your rooms can be blocked off by a single move, your opponents are very incentivized to do that and to block two of your rooms off at once. So placing your rooms, you know, scattered throughout the castle, I find is generally a better strategy. It's more likely that your rooms will be closed off, or that your rooms will be completed, or rather, when one of your rooms gets closed off, at least you have another room to finish later.
Yeah. Just, I want to make a mention about point values.
Okay.
So, favor tiles are very important, because they can give you 10 to 20 points. And so, like, for example, getting 10 points with swans requires you to get one of every color, or some similar comparison, like 4 of every color and then 3 of every color. Or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. 1 of 3 colors, 1 of 4 colors, something like that. And then getting 10 points with, like, activity rooms requires completing 2 rooms, which means a total of 8 rooms built, give or take a few for doors that are connecting. And getting 10 points from a column is really hard. Getting 10 points from a row is a little easier, but still kind of hard. So favor tiles give you a pretty significant amount of points for essentially no effort other than getting the favor tile.
Mm-hmm.
Because ideally, any like tiles you get or build would fill that favor tile's objective. If you see people who are building heavily into one sort of branch of the, like one type of room, then it's really good to get tiles that say to have the fewest of those. It's sort of a way to leech off of other people's success.
This is I find that the favor tiles that ask you to get the fewest of somethings are definitely the easiest ones to achieve as long as you haven't gotten any of them.
Right,
yet.
Because they require literally zero effort.
Right, either you just don't get that kind of room from the trade row, or in the case of swans, you try not to match those color of doors and place rooms with that color of doors. When you do place rooms with that color of doors, you just want to try to spend them on the things that you can spend swans on.
Yeah, the fact that you can spend swans really helps the favor tiles for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is doubly true for the like public favors, is that if you see somebody who is building a specific type of room that the public favors asked to have the fewest of, then you should definitely try not to build those. Pay close mm-hmm. attention to everybody else's sort of totals built. And then this is all also why getting the tiebreaker is so important. Because
the tiebreaker is basically mandatory.
Yeah.
And it's not like, you know, nobody has to get it until someone has to get it. It's not like the tiebreaker gives you an advantage over somebody else. It's just that, like, you literally need the tiebreaker in order to score points from many of your private favors.
Right. This is sort of because the amount of rooms, especially, that you build are not that high of a range. Like, sure, you can build 5 of one room type, but in every game I've played, the difference between, like, the most of one room and the least of one room has been only 2 or 3, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you end up not having enough time to build more than 5 rooms for most room types.
Yeah, because the range is pretty small, then it's pretty likely that 2 people end up with the same number of something.
Exactly.
And in the case of having the least, 0 counts as the least, and multiple people could just happen to have 0 of a thing by the end of the game.
Yeah.
They may do it completely inadvertently.
Right.
I just want to say that the times that we've played, I think that favor tiles have accounted for like 2/3 to like 75% of most players' points by the end of the game.
It's a lot, yeah.
And you mentioned that they can be worth 10 to 20 points. Getting those 20-point favors is very big.
Yes, especially.
And achieving them.
Those are definitely worth playing for, building around, etc.
I definitely want to recommend playing mean and cutting off other players' rooms whenever you can. Just because the game ends pretty quickly if you play nicely and you just let everybody complete their rooms and you help them complete their rooms. The game can end pretty quickly. So you want the game to extend just so that you have time to complete your own rooms and complete the rooms that matter to you, you know? There might be turns where the rooms really interest you, so you'll just throw one in there. And in a game where you're playing nice, that room will get completed and you'll get the bonus, but you won't really care to get the bonus. In some cases, you might not even want to get the bonus. Like, if people are playing too nice, you might be getting swans that you'd rather not collect because you're trying to have the least of them. So anyways, I highly recommend playing mean in this game. Extend the game and accomplish the tasks that you're aiming to accomplish.
In a similar vein, late game, I recommend building stairs because since there always has to be one upstairs room or one upstairs door available, once it gets to the point where there's a total of like 3 upstairs doors or 2, building stairs allows you to really control where the next players have to place their rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, if you build a stairs and there's no basement tiles in the row, then everybody else has to squeeze in whatever tiles are available into whatever rooms are available, which could also mean like they can't play any utility rooms in the trade row if there's only one door remaining.
Right. Speaking of utility rooms, they're very useful for ending the game quicker.
Yeah.
When the game gets to a certain point, You know, maybe you notice that somebody has a lot of rooms that they're very close to completing, and doing so would give them a lot of resources or points that could make the difference at the end of the game. So you might want to just complete a random room so that you can place like 4 or 6 motes and block those rooms off ASAP. You could even split your moat, you know, place a couple over on one side, a couple on the other, just to block off like 2 rooms at a critical moment towards the end of the game.
Right.
Or to just end the game outright, because like maybe, you know, if you let the game go for another round, people might accidentally give you swans that you don't want, or people might collect some more swans from completing some of their rooms, which gives them the most of a certain kind of swan. And that's something you want to avoid. So sometimes you might just see an opportunity where if the game ended now, I would win these public events or these public favors, and I would have the most for this private favor. So I'm just going to end it now. So just place a random room, complete it, and fill the moats in.
Yeah. Similarly, utility rooms are kind of the same as like the favors for having the most of something, to where if you already have a favor that asks for the most of something, then it's really good to get a utility room for the same thing, because it just doubles your points almost. You know, if you have 4 living rooms and you have a utility room that says to have the most living rooms, then that would pass that 10-point threshold. So they're pretty useful.
Another thing that you can, like a decision you can make for the end of the game, is that if you realize that the game is bound to end before your next turn is coming around, then you can aim to just take some actions that'll give you the most points for endgame scoring. So that can mean like playing some of your extra swans that you don't need for anything to unlock a bonus that could give you like 10 bonus points, or give you those 3 swans so you could complete more sets of swans, or get the tiebreaker if you haven't gotten that yet. So keep that in mind too when the game is coming to an end. You could choose to end it yourself, or you could take actions that give you just a couple bonus points.
Yeah. I will say that the 3 swan bonus is roughly 8 points, if you consider that you're going from a set of 2 to a set of 5, which is less than the 10-point bonus.
Yeah, the 10-point bonus is definitely probably the best one to shoot for.
Other than, of course, tiebreaker.
Sure. Real quick, of all the bonuses, which ones do you think, other than tiebreaker, are worth getting over the course of the game?
I honestly don't think there are any others that are worth getting all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the like cost reduction is nice, but it's more so if you're trying to go for very specific rooms. I think if you want to get specific utilities, then it's helpful. But I don't know. Or like if you're trying to go for rows, then it's helpful to get at least 1 cost reducer. Mm-hmm. Because then you have access to 4 free tiles. But I think a big part is that in kind of every game I've played, I've ended up with a lot of swans of 1 color. And I mean, part of that's just because of the objectives and how they work with the favors. But at the same time, that means that there's a lot of swans that are only giving you 1 point that you could just spend on getting a better room that ends up giving you like 5 points total or something like that.
All right. Do you have any other strategy tips?
Not really.
Then shall we take a quick plug break and then get into design discussion?
Yes.
All right. Lovely plug theme that was.
Plugly.
So, it was not plugly, it was not.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
It was plug-utiful. Plovely. I like that one. Okay. So if you'd like, we would appreciate it if you followed us on social media at Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast, where you can chat with us, hit us up with suggestions for games that you'd like to hear our thoughts on, or just shoot us some questions and we'll answer them. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, to find all of our episodes posted and cataloged. You can browse through the tags or use our search bar function to find episodes on topics that you'd like. There's also a submission form for suggestions on our website if you'd like to use that to hit us up with suggestions for games to review. You can also find a link to our TeePublic store on our website. That's teepublic.com/user/bgbcast, where you can find stuff with our cool logo printed on it. That does it for BG Bros plugs. Let's hear Matt plugs.
You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming. I tweet about things that I'm thinking about, hot takes, little reviews of games that I'm playing, just whatever. But also you can see my tweets about projects I'm working on and when I go live on my stream, which I stream at twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday from 1 p.m. Central Time to about 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time. I stream a lot of competitive games, roguelites, strategy games. I've been playing Hitman on Fridays, which is pretty fun. So if any of that interests you, check it out. It's always analytical and fun and exciting. And also, as of the time this is releasing, on August 19th, so the next Thursday, I will be doing a charity stream for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, a cause that's very near and dear to me, as part of their Game Over T1D charity drive. And for that, I will be playing the game Fortune Street, which we've done an episode on before. And I said that for every $50 that I raise, I'm going to increase the target amount, and I'm pretty sure I've hit the maximum target amount, which means it's going to be a very long, very arduous, but very fun game of Fortune Street.
Gonna be a real slobber knocker.
Yes. So, if you're interested in checking that out, interested in supporting a great cause that goes to researching a, really serious thing, then come check that out.
Twitch.tv/twack.
Yes.
All right. You could also check out Matthew's other podcast if you like.
Netflix, oh, right.
For Pro. Hold on. Let me try this one. A Whirlwind Ride Through the World Wide Web.
Yes. Where and my friend Galen talk about media from the 21st century, give or take a few years. Our most recent episode just came out, and it was about the album Comfort Eagle by the band Cake. So we've covered music, video games, movies, TV shows, internet stuff. So it's a critical podcast analyzing just kind of a lot of interesting things.
All right. And for all things business or funny, haha, you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs.
Business or pleasure?
Business or funny, haha.
Okay.
All right. That does it for plugs. Let's get to our design discussion.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see. I don't honestly have a ton to talk about when it comes to the design of this game. Because, I don't know, maybe it's just that we've talked a lot about similar things in the Between Two Castles episode.
Yeah.
So, but a couple things do stand out to me. Of, like, things that I think this game could use a little more, like, finesse on, which is namely the basement and moat placement rules.
Basement and placement.
I'm not sure. Basement and placement. I just think, like, I wonder how important it is for a rule to be explainable via words rather than pictures. I think, like you mentioned, the pictures do a pretty good job of explaining the placement rules. Still not a perfect job, but a slightly better job than the words do when it comes to like placing moats and placing basement tiles and stairs. But it seems a little fiddly and that it could use like a little more explanation or something there.
Something I've realized is that some people are better at reading the rule book than others. And I don't mean that as like a slight against anybody, but there are some people that do better when they're told how a game works versus how when they read it. And that's also because there are people who are good at explaining the rules for games.
Sure.
But like if you go to a board game convention, at least when we've gone to like Geekway to the West, you can always put up a little flag that says like rules explanation needed, you know, need a teacher. And so I think having an explanation for mechanics or having mechanics that are explained in words possibly, or that are easier to explain in words, kind of lends itself to that, just the fact that people learn better in different ways. I think With the moat placement tiles, I get the idea they're going for, that they like, they kind of found these edge cases, like with the little inlets, and their goal was to make it so that you couldn't skip moats, you know, like you can't cut corners literally. And I think that's for the purpose of like pacing and balance.
Edge cases.
Yeah. But.
Because it's the edge of the board.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does lead to the moat tiles being a little more complex as far as like, wait, can I do this?
Mm-hmm.
I think, well, there's some.
I know that some games, what they'll do is they'll explain the rule, you know, in a simple form. And then if there are edge cases, there's like a little box off to the side, or like a more info paragraph late at a further point in the rule book.
Yeah.
Something like that. And I guess I can appreciate that because it gets to the center of what the rule is trying to get you to do first. And then if you need more clarity, then it offers it in another place.
Yeah.
Sometimes very close by. And I think this game doesn't do that. Maybe this game was just made. I mean, I guess it was published in 2017, but, you know, maybe they just didn't think to lay things out that way. And they just thought, like, let's just put it all in the same paragraph so that it's all there.
Right.
You know, for some, it's still comprehensible.
Comprehensive.
And to others, it might get a little too confusing too quickly. I guess it also helps that they have, I'll give them props for having a useful image associated, because that's definitely needed. But a slight ding for, not being quite as descriptive or as useful as it could be in the writing itself.
Yeah. I found that a lot of times playing this game, there's a lot to keep track of when you place a tile.
Oh, there is a lot of bookkeeping when, like, it comes to placing a tile.
When you place a tile, you have to check whether it's immediately completed. And if it is, then you have a whole lot of other things. Mm-hmm. You have to add your tracker on your blueprint board. You have to check for swans. If there's another player, you have to tell them what swan they're getting. Maybe this is a matter of, like, attention span or something, but it definitely feels like every time I place a tile, I have to rethink, like, is there anything I'm forgetting? It's like when I'm trying to pack for a vacation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you do forget it, it could be, like, it could have pretty drastic consequences. Like, if you forgot to move your tracker on your blueprint board, you might be missing out on bonuses or bonus points. If you forgot to place your piece on it, not only is there no way to show who owns it, which is one way of also checking to make sure you have your blueprint board trackers correct, as you can count the rooms that you have your pieces on. If you forget to put your thing on it, then you can't count it. But also, like, you won't be able to indicate when it's completed, which might make you skip a thing. You could totally miss having completed a room after you place a tile. You might be so focused on your own tile that you don't realize you're completing another one. So that could get missed, which means that moat tiles may not have been added to the board when they should have been added, which could have closed off another room that now has its opening still to be completed with.
If you forget to get your swan, then you might have not had a swan to pay earlier or later on, or like, you could have paid a different swan, which would have adjusted your points, much less the whole getting favors for having the most swans or at least swans of a type.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, yeah. I agree with you here that, yeah, this is another part of the game that's a little fiddly. This part just requires you to follow a lot of steps. And I think maybe one thing that could have helped this game with that is, like, a card or something to the game. I guess a card wouldn't have made a lot of sense because there are no cards to this game.
I mean,
they wouldn't have had, like, a deck to slot it with. But maybe a portion of a board that just explains, like, here's the order of operations for when you place a tile, you know?
Yeah.
Add your token, slide the token, check to see if any rooms have been completed, and flip their tokens. Then follow their bonuses in turn order. And if you have multiples, then, you know, do them in whatever order you choose or the owner chooses.
Right. The last thing that I think is a kind of knock against this game is that the red and purple are too similar. And honestly, kind of the blue as well. I'm not really colorblind, but I had a lot of trouble discerning colors for this game.
Mm.
Mainly the swan colors.
At least this game uses a different swan icon for every color.
Does it?
It does, yeah.
Oh, I never noticed. If you go back
and check, it actually does.
That's impressive.
The thing is, but they are very similar, so it's not an easy distinction to pick up on.
Exactly.
And also, it's not really intuitive to what the color is. Like, I mean, swans are white. They're not red and blue. It's not like if I showed you the silhouette of a swan, you'd be like, oh, that's a blue silhouette of a swan. You just have to kind of know that, like, this swan icon is the purple swan icon, even though there's nothing really purple about it. It's just got, like, an extra feather on its wing, or maybe a longer bill or something like that.
Also, the swan...
So it has that, but it's not prominent enough.
Also, the swan icons can get really tiny on rooms.
Oh,
if you look at, like, living rooms and or just doors in general, or the hallways, and look at the bonus swans, that one, I guess, it's always the door that isn't represented. But if you're at an eye angle that makes it hard to tell apart the doors already, then it doesn't really help.
I do like that, or no, I don't like this. I don't like that there's a lot of small pieces to this game.
Yeah, it reminds me of Food Chain Magnate.
Although these pieces are all flat because they get punched out of cardboard, as opposed to Food Chain's wooden bottles and hot dogs and stuff.
Pizzas.
I enjoy the ramp and speed that this game has. And that this is one of those games where the players control when it ends. There's still sort of an inevitability to the game ending, but players have more agency over that versus just a set number of turns.
Yeah.
It's also kind of interesting that ending the game is a part of, like, the strategy in this game. I guess I'm not exactly sure what I'm trying to make, but
it's incredibly variable.
But one point I will make is that I do enjoy that this game utilizes their die cuts pretty well, just because, like, they could have made favor tiles a different die cut shape than room tiles, but they've used the shape of the blueprint board in a way, or they've designed the shape of the blueprint board so that they don't have to do that. I know die cutting, like making new die cuts, can cost a lot of money. So being able to use the same die cut to punch out the favor tiles and the room tiles probably saved a lot of money. And the only thing they had to do is design those notches for the upgrades / slots for favors on the blueprint boards the way that they are now. So they can use the square in two different ways.
Yeah, the blueprint board design's very clever in how it both saves on money, like you said, and it provides these interesting decisions during the game.
Yes, absolutely.
Speaking of interesting decisions, something I think is really cool about this game and how it utilizes shared spaces. So, I believe the original Castle of Mad King Ludwig had, like, personal castles you were designing, and you drafted rooms to build them. And then Between Two Castles has technically shared castles, but you have two and you build them with your partners. This game is... it's everybody's building the same palace, and we talked a lot in the strategy about how, like, you can kind of coerce opponents into building in specific ways, or you can try to play in a way that incidentally helps you out. And I think that's really just an interesting decision space to explore. So, like, the way the doors work has an interesting decision of how you kind of want to play close to your own pieces, because then your opponents don't get swans, but then that makes you an easy target, so then you'd want to play closer to your opponents, but then they can get swans. It's a very, like, that decision of how the way doors work when you connect them leads to a lot of interesting outcomes. And then wanting to complete tiles is also super complicated, as we've explained in the strategy portions. I think what this leads to is a game where there aren't really any optimal choices other than getting the tiebreakers. But like, wherever you play a tile, like, there's always going to be trade-offs, which... part of the appeal of strategy games is having trade-offs and decisions.
Yeah.
And so it's like, this game really uses the idea of everybody building the same palace not to make like a cooperative game about building a cool palace, and not by making things always indirectly help out, but like really forcing players into these tricky decisions.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little like the only game I can think of that does this to the same degree is Carcassonne, but also not exactly. I think this game is pretty unique in how it tackles that Sharia.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. The other main topic I wanted to bring up is board game series. I think this is something super interesting. Uh-huh. Maybe not just because of Mad King Ludwig, but so board gaming as a hobby, there's kind of a implicit understanding that games are made to be replayed. Obviously, nowadays there are legacy games or campaign-driven games like Gloomhaven, which I guess is sort of a legacy game.
It's sort of a legacy. I think it's made so that you can reset it if you need to.
Right, or games like Descent. But most board games, especially strategy games like this, are intended to be replayed. They're designed and marketed and sold to be replayed, and people buy them with the intention that they will be replayed, or the expectation that they'll be replayed. Which means that board games that want to have a series, like you don't see as many board game series as you do movie series or video game series. Those can build off existing things because they don't necessarily have to exist in the same space as the original.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most board games, since they're kind of self-contained, making a sequel almost means you have to do something different because players are still going to replay the original game. And so most board game series, they are either in the form of expansions, which is the most common. Something like Dominion is sort of a franchise or a series, but it's made up of mostly of expansions. Or you just make like a completely separate game that plays off of the design and graphic design of the original, but has its own flair. We've talked about Indian Summer, which was part of a series by Uwe Rosenberg, and that series all kind of has similar mechanics and similar concepts, but with different execution and different decisions. The Mad King Ludwig mainly uses its graphic design and its sort of tile placement motif to sort of draw comparisons between the game. So somebody who plays this game will have some idea of how Between Two Castles works. They'll know that utility rooms will want all of a whole bunch of a certain room type, and so they're kind of splashable, you know? Or food rooms give you some sort of bonus when you complete them. That's sort of a stretch. But, like, the fact that these room types are kind of similar between the games means that they're easier to approach. And then it also highlights the differences between the games. I think one of the first things one of us said when we read the rules was that, oh, hallways can't be placed in the basements in this game.
Right.
Which is kind of a surprise. It kind of took a little bit of mentally getting used to, but I think once I got used to it, it let me sort of appreciate the differences in how the basements play out in both games. Which is to say, I don't like the basement in Palace of Mad King Ludwig as much as I do in Between Two Castles, but, you know.
Yeah.
It's just a bit more restrictive with only having one room type you can place and also requiring stairs to be built. But yeah, I just think board game series are really interesting, and I kind of wish there were more that weren't either expansions or like re-themes. Like, you could kind of think of Flux as a series, but it just has a bunch of re-themes of the same core concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I would enjoy playing another game in the Scythe universe that's not a 4X game.
Yeah.
I think that would be cool.
Yeah, you do also see games with similar settings, but they're not quite the same, like, the same game, you know?
Yeah.
The West Kingdom games, for example, are like this. I think my favorite example is Century, where each game has its own sort of unique mechanics, but they can be combined in different ways. that's just an example of another good series of board games that I don't think we've covered.
Nope. Maybe this is a little sneak preview for some games that we'll be covering in the immediate future then.
Yeah. But I think that's about it.
All right. The last thing I want to say is I really appreciate the rule that the size of the playing area is the edge of the table.
Oh, yes. That's a very fun rule.
And that you cannot shift the pieces as you play.
I almost want to like build a Lego baseboard to put tiles on and be like, it's a table on a table. So it restricts it even further. I don't know if that makes sense, but
I don't know if that makes sense either to me, but
like,
but
imagine if you had a table specifically made for playing the Palace of Mad King Ludwig on. That's okay. Like a weird shape.
Gotcha. I see. So mm-hmm. The edge of the table is a very specific choice that you've made.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Something for the future, maybe.
Or for the viewers to try out if they want. Who knows?
Bespoke Palace of Mad King Ludwig tables? Who knows what the future holds? But we know that it won't hold any more discussion on Palace of the Mad King Ludwig in this episode, because this is the end of our discussion on the Palace of the Mad King Ludwig.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next episode.
See ya.